Hello and welcome, everyone. I'm Craig Holiday. I'm one of the founding members of the Association for Spiritual Integrity. I'm also a spiritual teacher and a therapist. Today with me is David Buckland, who's known online for his pen name and his website, Davidya. That's Davidya.ca. He's up in Canada. David's a good friend of mine and someone who I deeply respect for his awakened vision, his humility. He's also someone who's been meditating for 45 plus years. He briefly taught TM a while back. He has a master's in Vedic science, which is, you know, essentially Eastern philosophy. And he's been on Buddha at the Gas Pump a number of times. David is someone who I respect, and I've always found that he has great insight. And so I thought I'd have him on the program today. And this program is where teachers are getting together and speaking peer to peer. So on some programs, an individual will interview the speaker and then the teacher will talk. In other programs, like this one, we're inviting teachers to talk and to share and to meet from a place of humility and share their experience, you know, in regards to ethical insight and personal growth on the path. And so, David, welcome. It's so nice to have you here today.
Thanks, Greg. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you. So when David and I were emailing back and forth and, wondering, well, what should we speak about? One of the topics David brought up is spiritual bypassing. And David wrote this in his first email to me. He said that the tendency to escape into a spiritual avoidance amplified by renunciate practices, when it's used inappropriately, is one great form of spiritual bypassing. And this type of bypassing, it can cause great pain and confusion within the teacher, within the teacher's community or sangha, within the students. And so, David, I'm just going to open it up to you and invite you to share, you know, what have you noticed, you know, over your 45 years of practice and, you know, being around the block, you know, a day or two and having known and worked with teachers intimately and seen teachers at a distance. And the big thing that we're inviting is, you know, this isn't a program where we're just want to sit around and talk about what people have done that didn't work well. We want to talk about what has worked well and some cases, you know, that didn't work so well that individuals you worked with. Of course, we're not going to name any names and, you know, start any fights or any drama or anything silly like that. You know, that would be unproductive. The idea here is to create greater ethical insight and awareness. And so, yeah, please, David, what's on your mind?
Well, thanks, Greg. Yeah, it's one of those things. Life can be deeply challenging. Sometimes we can go through phases that are very difficult, and it's an easy tendency to want to escape through a spiritual practice or a spiritual environment. You know, going off to an ashram or something like that. And certainly, those kinds of things are very valuable for getting a break or a bit of a rest or a refresh. But there's that tendency that can be there to make it a habit, to get into the habit of escaping. And then if we're using spiritual practices to escape our life, then it's not really going to give us the benefits that we're hoping for there. Because the idea of spirituality really is about bringing the insight out into the world, out into our life fully. Not just to have it as some abstraction that's an inside experience we have during meditation or some such thing, but something that we can live all the time, which is certainly the goal of most spiritual practices. And if we take those practices and use them in a kind of a secondary way, then that can get us a little bit in a kind of culture bad habits that don't really support us long term, and we can miss the goal as a result.
Yeah, that's something that I actually saw in myself, I can say with all transparency, early on the path. I came into this world and had very intense renunciate desires and lifestyle. I mean, even when I was 14 years old, I began just sleeping on the floor. And I was so interested in spirituality at a young age. And my idea of spirituality, you know, despite, you know, growing up in a, you know, basically I had Catholic spiritual conditioning, what I brought with me was conditioning from previous incarnations where I had all this karma of being a monk. And so I thought, you know, I have to be poor. I have to sleep on the floor. I have to starve myself to death. I have to be
vegetarian.
Everyone else first. And, you know, it just carried into, you know, my first experience with my teacher is all I wanted to do was, you know, hide out, you know, on the hillside with him. When I first met him, basically I met him and he gave me a job and we were going to build a retreat center and a temple and gardens. And so, you know, I'd like the perfect little guru teacher relationship with him. And I started to have this intense division between my life, his name was actually David also, but my life with David, and then my life in the outside world. And I just wanted to give everything to this one life with my teacher and completely escape and avoid everything in the outside world. And, you know, it worked very well in the beginning because it helped me get my power all together and be very clear and disciplined. But anytime I tried to have a relationship with the outside world, I realized that I had intense aversion to it. You know, so I was bypassing anything to do with the exterior world while, you know, going deep with my teacher. And so I was making tremendous progress in one way, but I was failing miserably in another way.
Yeah, I remember I went on a 6-month retreat about 9 months after I started meditating. So I was also very keen to become, you know, make rapid progress and so on. And I recall reading in the back of one of my teacher's books, he talked about the different yogas or paths to enlightenment. And I have a very strong mind. And so I thought, oh, I read about it. And oh, I must be on the intellectual path. And the book said, oh, this is the path of the renunciate. You have to renounce the world and get the world so that you can focus on these inner insights and follow that path and not be distracted by the world. However, like yourself, I have some past life karma and history of being a monk as well, but that's not what was called for this life. And I spent a while thrashing around trying to figure out how I could play that role in our modern culture, because there wasn't that avenue available to me at that time. It did become available later, but by that time I kind of figured that one out. So I didn't get too far down that path. But yeah, it's so easy to look for some ideal, some spiritual ideal, and chase after that.
And I find that you know, many teachers in modern spirituality, they teach a form of spirituality that, you know, oftentimes doesn't include our human self. And, you know, that was always incredibly confusing to me, you know, especially because, you know, I can say just with my own life, my teacher really challenged me to be in the world, to respond to the world. But he also challenged me to, you know, to know what is really important to you. And I kind of took his words of, you know, like, know what's important, Craig. And then I did this overlay of renunciation upon it. And I just, you know, mimicked, you know, everything I read from Ramakrishna to Vivekananda to Yogananda to any Ananda, you know, and I read the, you know, the Christian saints, and, you know, they all lived in utter poverty and prayer. And of course, like you were saying, they lived in a monastery or a convent. And so I kept trying to impose that on the rest of my on the rest of my life. But I also noticed, you know, like I met my teacher when I was 19, and I spent a couple years in my early 20s living celibate and not being in relationship. But he also encouraged me to go to college too. And so, you know, I'd go to college and then, you know, work for him in the afternoons and the mornings and on the weekends. I lived a very divided life because, you know, of course, at college, there was all kinds of girls and parties and people doing this and that. And, you know, I didn't know how to relate to it all. I couldn't figure out how to make it work. So I just tried to continually bypass the whole experience of college. And essentially, I did a pretty good job of it. And, you know, like I said, I was celibate for a number of years in the beginning there. But then this funny thing happened. Of course, I can say, you know, with humility, I met a girl, or rather, you know, she met me. She deeply pursued me. And, you know, basically she wore me down. Eventually we got together, and it wasn't long after that where I realized it was a bad idea. And as I was on my way out the door saying, hey, you know, I'm going to go off and become a monk again. You know, she looked at me and said, I'm pregnant. And I said, oh boy, you know, oh boy. And I created a great mess where, you know, I was bringing a child into the world and I wasn't ready for it. I didn't have any training. I wasn't thinking about being a father. And to be honest, like the whole thing, you know, the pregnancy was a train wreck until I saw my daughter come forward, and then something woke up in my heart where I realized this path of bypassing and renunciation. I saw that it just had so much division in it, so much divisiveness. And when I saw that, my daughter, this bright little angel, all this love woke up in my heart, which had a different energetic quality than, say, you know, the quality that was driving my path before, which was like pure egoic will, you know, just like will. I'm going to achieve, you know, enlightenment or awakening or whatever it was, or I'm going to be the best student ever for my teacher. It was just pure will. But when I saw that little girl come forward, my heart came online. And that was really difficult then to bypass, because it was just very clear that God had given me this gift. And it brought me, you know, here, you know, onto planet Earth.
Yes.
And I said, oh, my spirituality must change. But again, because I had read so many books, you know, by monks, by nuns, by people who lived at ashrams, there weren't any great models for me to follow.
Yeah.
You know, as far as living in the world. And I found it very, very confusing. It's like, how do I live this spirituality?
Yeah.
So it becomes very practical.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective too. Because it's useful to understand the larger cycles of time, I guess you could say, as we go through cycles of rising and falling consciousness in the world. And during the dark age that we've been rising out of, you basically have to withdraw from the world to make any progress, because the world is so muddy, basically, is the way they talk about it. And so for some period of time now, and most of, you know, well-known spiritual teachers have come out of a time where renunciation was the way, and essentially Shankara came and created that whole tradition, and his process was reviving the monastic tradition because it had been pretty much lost at that time, and so he revived the tradition, to help people migrate through the darker age. But then it became dominant, which was needed at the time. But now we're moving into a different time, and it's no longer necessary. And so you have many people like ourselves who have had some older history with being renunciates, and so have it that way. Coming into the world, it's no longer what we need. The what we need now is something different. And but there, you know, as you mentioned, all the examples are of something different, of the old way, basically. Of the, you know, going off to the monastery or the ashram or whatever. But it's fascinating to watch too, because, you know, we can even see within the spiritual teachers that are alive today, there's the earlier ones who went off and spent a long time in India or similar, some place, in an ashram or something and woke up that way. And then you have this wave of people who, a little bit more recent, who also went to India, but for much shorter periods of time, essentially spending time with their awake teacher and so on like that. And now you have people waking up in the world who even some of them don't even have a spiritual history or in this lifetime, anything they're aware of. And it's just happening. And then there's all these people who have been meditating for decades now that are being exposed to people who are awake, and that's triggering the shift. And so many, many people are waking up, listening to a spiritual teacher or going on a weekend retreat. No India required.
Yeah, and it's actually quite incredible. And, one of the things that, I find really heartbreaking is when I see someone who, like you're describing, maybe they don't have, a lot of spiritual training, or, they haven't been on the path for years, but they may find themselves at a meditation retreat or having a spontaneous awakening. And then, of course, with true spiritual awakening, it's not like it's something that just happens once and then we're forever free.
Right.
That happens, and then that's like getting your foot in the door, and then there's all this training and healing and growth, that needs to happen.
Yeah, there's a whole process of maturing and integrating and embodying that shift. And it can be really, really useful to have some understanding about what's going on. Otherwise, you can get into problems over it.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've seen that has been really heartbreaking is when an individual, say, who's not on the monastic path, which is, most of the planet, they start to wake up or they start to get involved in spirituality, and say they have a family and a job and a career and this and that. And then the teacher or the tradition or the lineage, offers them a monastic teaching, a monastic response to their everyday struggles. And, more and more I find that, my email inbox is just full of people reaching out, and they have questions, and they say, well, I'm studying Tibetan Buddhism, and the teacher is telling me to do this, but I have kids and I can't just go on the 3-month-long retreat, and I can't give everything to the to the Sangha or the lineage. How do I respond? Like, how is this helpful? And one of the things that I did, and I see a lot of people doing, is oftentimes we take this overlay of a monastic path and we're living in the world, and we use that path in a sense like to do violence to our own humanity, where we're trying to get rid of ourselves. And I was actually a master at that for many years, where and one day I just woke up and I realized I am being so utterly violent, to the human, Craig, to the personality, to the character, to the human person who's here, always trying to get rid of him, go to war with him, use some kind of non-dual tricks, to say, oh, that's just a person, he doesn't exist, or that's just personal, and that's, I shouldn't have any personal thoughts or beliefs or opinions or this and that. And, time and time again, I'm hit with these questions of, like, what's true, Craig? Is it we are a person? Are we not a person? Like, what's the truth? I look at it as both, and that we do have a human self here. We do have a soul that's here. There's all these layers and levels to it. And you're, when I look at your teachings, you're like a master of those layers and levels. But I like to honor both, that we have an inner child, we have a soul, and if we just try to transcend or ignore it or deny it, we're going to get in great trouble. That's going to manifest, just from a psychological perspective, in a neurotic way or some form of neurosis. And so.
Right, and sometimes what happens is that people wake up without understanding how they woke up, and become teachers. And so what they teach is how to experience like they're experiencing.
Yes.
Whereas what happened for them arose spontaneously as a natural side effect of their awakening. And they're trying to get people to mimic that. And, and you know, and then you get into the denial of, you know, the person and that kind of thing, when it's not being honest to what their experience is at that point. And it's also useful to understand that, as you mentioned, that the process unfolds in stages. And so what is true at one stage is not so true at another stage. So when you're reading these old philosophies where they talk about this is reality and this is not, and so on like that, those change several times during the process. And so what can be completely true at one stage is, a good example is the way non-duality is used. Non-duality is actually a fairly advanced stage of development, where there's actually a oneness. For example, in initial self-realization, or cosmic consciousness as it's sometimes called, there's an awakening of the self within, and yet there's still this separate world, which may be experienced as illusory, but not necessarily. That depends on another factor. But in the old text described this as dvaita, duality, because there's a two-ness. And we can say, well, that's illusory world, so we can discount that. Only what's here is real. And yet it's still there in the experience. But it's only actually later on when the experience deepens and we recognize that the world itself is playing out on a screen of consciousness that becomes our living reality, then that the objective world and the subjective world are united. And then you get the beginnings of non-duality. I talked about that at the Science and Non-Duality Conference a couple of years ago. And so if you take those principles of non-duality and try to apply it to your life when you're still, you know, attached to the ego, you can really create inner division and conflict, because you're adopting a philosophy that doesn't correspond to your reality. And certainly it's useful to culture the next step, you know, to be culturing. So this is what I normally experience, but here's next step, and you know, I can favor that, and that can be very useful, but not as a way to control, because that's, you know, ego has this habit of getting involved in everything and trying to take over and control of spiritual practices and spiritual philosophies and all this kind of thing, and turning it into a control thing, which is also can be closely related to the bypassing. And get into this whole story.
A control, and I mean the other thing that I've seen, you know, just when working with a number of different colleagues and friends and people I've mentored on the path, is that people can often use it as a defense as well.
Yeah.
So an unwillingness to see or face one's humanity. And to me, you know, if this path is truly about oneness and the experience of oneness, you know, if you look at oneness, oneness is radically inclusive.
Yes.
It includes all levels of being, whereas often, you know, one of the shadow sides of spirituality is oneness is taught as a particular state that feels really good, and it's radically exclusive. But yeah, that could never be the truth. How could oneness be exclusive? Oneness has to include all levels of our being, all levels, you know, of, say, planetary consciousness, collective consciousness, each other's consciousness. And, you know, if it's not inclusive, it's probably lacking heart. therefore, there must be a huge shadow there. That's one of the great things I look for is, you know, does the teaching, you know, is there clarity there? Is there, you know, big heart there? That's radical inclusivity. And is there some type of presence of indestructibility where it's, you know, it's persistent, it's consistent, you know, it's stabilized.
Right.
And you raise an aspect of courage. Yeah.
Yeah. And you raise a really important point there, because a lot of the bypassing comes up because people are not comfortable with their experience of their body mind or their personality or whatever. And usually that's because of suppressed emotions, old traumas, that kind of thing that they've not yet dealt with, and that kind of stuff. I've been astonished how skillful we can be at hiding from ourselves, at suppressing old traumas and stuff. And there's a certain value to that, in that we don't want to be dealing, you know, having our trauma in our face all the time. We need to be able to function in our life and so on like that. But we also need to give the time and attention to healing that stuff, because otherwise we can't open the heart, because it's not a safe for it to open into. We can't be comfortable with being in this body mind because it's just this difficult place. And even when we've dealt with some of that stuff, there's usually still some in the background there. And when it's not conscious, it's still kind of like a shadow or a filter that's there, that's influencing our experiences. And this is where it becomes really valuable to have peers and a normal social life, which some spiritual teachers lose because they don't have a balanced life necessarily. There can be that tendency.
Yeah, a lot of teachers live in that position of the Almighty, you know.
And then there's nobody there to call you on your stuff, and so then what can happen is those shadows can show up in the context of the teaching, and we end up working the stuff out instead of, you know, in the usual way on a more appropriate ways, with a therapist or with, you know, talking things out with friends or something. We're ending up dumping on our students or something like that. Now, to be clear here, I'm not a spiritual teacher in that sense. My role is mainly as a writer and author. I'm more skilled in that arena.
But David, you bring up a really interesting point, and I don't think I've ever heard anyone say that before. And I think, you know, the way that you said that was really interesting, because I see that often as well. Is that, you know, sometimes when a teacher, if they don't have any feedback loops, if they don't, if they're not in relationship, a marriage, you know, if they're don't have, you know, just healthy, not only role models, supervision, peers.
But even marriage, you know, I've seen that before. A teacher friend of mine kind of went off the rails when some old identity stuff surfaced, and he started, won't go into details, but he basically expected his wife to become his devotee. And she stepped into that role. So she was basically supporting him. And was actually actively attacking people on social media and stuff like that who disagreed with them. So you can get it's very valuable to have a partner who is an equal partner.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the main issues It's one of the main things about teaching that isn't often isn't always conscious, because people don't become spiritual teachers because they've studied relationship dynamics. They become teachers because they've spoken and they have something to share. And so they're not necessarily aware of relationship dynamics and power dynamics and some of those things that like a therapist would study or something from a different field. That's one of the things I think that ASI is really valuable about. Is offering workshops that they've been doing to just inform some of that. I mean, I was familiar with some of the ideas, but it made it much more conscious and clear, which is really what you want in this whole thing, is just being more and more conscious. Then you're not going to get caught by stuff as well. So it's really useful to have friends. And it's also about life balance. I mean, I used to work in high tech, and it's an industry a little notorious for overwork and that kind of thing. And at a certain point, I realized that my marriage was suffering and so on, because I was just working too much, and I needed to bring in more life balance and actually culture a social life and bring more balance in there. But it's equally true in a spiritual context. Actually, maybe even more true in a spiritual context, to have that life balance, so that you do have people in your life that are calling you on your stuff. I'm very fortunate to have close friends who are more than happy to point out when there's something coming to the surface.
and it's a good thing. And you know, the beautiful thing is, you know, just to see you smile as you say that. You know, when I think of my life, I think of my wife. You know, she's very vocal and pointing out, you know, my shortcomings, and my teenage daughter, my 5-year-old.
Oh, a teenage daughter, boy, yeah.
That's... Yeah, and so I get it. I get it from all angles. But then I'm also a big fan of having a supervisor that I meet with, you know, and a supervisor would be something really similar to that I've had in the past with my spiritual teacher, where I used to meet with my spiritual teacher a number of times a week. So he was constantly giving me very helpful feedback, yeah, and challenging me to grow and to show up more fully. But to have a supervisor who I check in with about my clients, my students, the individuals I work with, you know, in regards to my teaching career. Of course, then I have some students who are more on the senior level and who I've invited, you know, please speak up and please give me feedback. And then just generally speaking, I have that, you know, it's just like a caveat is if you see something you don't like, speak up, or if something sounds a little off. And I just had a retreat a couple of weeks ago, and it was interesting. A student came forward and he really brought something to my attention, just the tone that I was using. I was speaking about something in a certain way, and he brought it to my attention, and it was actually very helpful. And then another student came forward and you know, spoke about my use of pronouns so that they'd be more inclusive. You know, I'm on a path of the Divine Mother, and so oftentimes I refer to God as her, and then sometimes I'll say he, sometimes I'll say she. And then this student was saying, hey, Craig, how about, can you throw, you know, they, them, there in there as well? You know, and open me up to have more gender fluid pronouns as well. And I thought, oh, that's good. I need education in this department, especially as our world is changing. My teenage daughter has taught me the same of, you know, gender pronouns are becoming much more fluid, and to be awake of that, to that, aware of that, not just brush it off. Or, you know, I've been a little bit old school in the past where I think, well, maybe that, you know, I don't know about that, but it's like, oh no, when you have a sense of humility, you can look out at life and it's easy to hear feedback, and it actually feels good to receive feedback because it helps, you know, to keep you honest. It helps keep you awake. It helps keep you on your feet and receptive to life. And this is another quality of oneness, is this ongoing receptivity toward life.
Yes.
Which is the opposite of saying being guarded, defended, or, you know, like the topic you brought up, bypassing and just saying this is spiritual, but oh, this other thing, you know, that's, you know, like you said, just stuff of the world. No, it's all spiritual. It's all divine. Can we open? Can we grow and embrace, you know, greater and greater manifestations of divinity, which, of course, are going to be more inclusive. More inclusive. They're going to have a higher level of inclusivity. And, you know, this point you brought up about, you know, the shadow of the teacher, I think it's amazing what you said, that, you know, if a teacher doesn't, you know, embrace their stuff, you know, within their everyday life, then it gets played out in the Sangha. And I can say I've seen that time and time again.
Yeah, myself
we
also.
Don't embrace it in our life.
Yeah, I had all these
part of the Sangha. Yeah.
Yeah, I had all these ideas about, oh, you know, after self-realization, then you know, there's all these qualities about it, and there's a certain perfection in action, and all this sort of, I don't even remember all that stuff anymore, but there's all these idealizing of what it would be to be awake. And what I've seen in myself and in many people around me, and even people in quite high stages, is there can still be stuff coming to the surface. And normally there will be, because, you know, it takes all, we've been spending lifetimes, you know, building up these old baggage, whatever, and certainly, you know, there is the idea that the mountains of karma are roasted when you wake up, but there's still, I would say that it's variable, a little bit variable how thorough that is, but also there's what's known as the sprouted seeds, the stuff that's still active in this lifetime that still has to play out. And so even though someone's very awake and very conscious of their stuff, they still have karma that's unfolding. And I don't know anybody that's you know, even I, you know, very white people that I know or have met that doesn't have some stuff in there that's coming to the surface over time. Because as you settle deeper and deeper and new, I mean, I've been astonished at, like I mentioned earlier, how thoroughly some of this stuff has been hidden. And just going through life, and over time, it comes to the surface in some way. And if you're not willing to look at it, or you're not willing to go there, then that stuff is just kept hidden away and casting shadows on your life and your behavior. Whereas if you are willing to engage it and work through this stuff, then it's you're going to get better results long term. And that whole side we talked about earlier, the side of the heart. Again, with that renunciate emphasis, there can be that ignoring the heart and just focusing on consciousness itself. But there's the whole fullness of enlightenment, the whole richness and that comes in all the stuff that's in between the surface and you know, absolute silence and all the layers of life. That's where all the richness comes in, and being able to embody that and bring it out into the world means we can also support the world more and more as well. So it's an important process, not only for our own development, but also how we're in the world.
Yeah, I think it's so true, especially what you're saying about this. You know, I'll use this word, like the mythical teachings on perfection in form. You know, it just seems, you know, so silly to me that we'd ever achieve, you know, some state of perfection. Now, there's the inherent perfection, the innate perfection, yes, which of course is unmanifest. And that's, you know, something we wake up to. It's like, oh, wow, this is incredible. You know, this is beyond, you know, it's existent, you know, throughout creation.
And there is a kind of...
Go ahead. Yeah.
I was just going to say, and there is a perfection to the forms of phenomena of the world as well. There is, yeah, a perfection to that. But, yeah, it's just a little foolish to think that we're done with our past.
It's like thinking that evolution doesn't exist or not existent. And, you know, one of the ways that Aurobindo spoke about God is, you know, God in two forms is the unmanifest, you know, innate perfection, which pervades everything, which creates everything, which is everything. And of course, that's beautiful. And then there's, you know, there's God in evolution, you know, God eternally giving birth, you know, growing. And it's like, if we think that we could ever outlive or out, you know, I don't even know how to say that, outgrow evolution, you know, that's pure arrogance. You know, achieve some level of enlightenment where, you know, evolution ceases to exist. I mean, what I've found on this path is, the further I go, the greater humility, the more I see within myself. And so at first, you know, it's all about clearing out, you know, our own karma. But then I see that my karma is attached to my father's karma, which is attached to his ancestors. As I open to it more and more, you know, at first I was working with my trauma, my individual trauma. And then I see, oh, I'm working with my father's trauma, then working with the ancestry trauma, then I work with the trauma of the earth and the planet and the whole collective consciousness, the species. It just seems to deepen more and more and more. And, you know, the shadows involved in it, the assumptions, the confusion, the ignorance, the collective shadow. And it's like more and more and more. And of course, it's oneness. So it works both ways. It's actually more darkness, more heaviness, you know, more, you know, mud and confusion and pain. And I mean, there's nothing I can't find within my own consciousness. And again, I'll say that with great humility, I can find war, you know, violence, incredible violence, all kinds of confused, you know, lustful thoughts and, you know, every level of, you know, the internet consciousness within myself and addiction and pain and confusion and every level of samsara within myself. And then as I look upward as well, pain and suffering and confusion, to the same extent, we start opening to greater and greater realms of divinity, freedom, light, you know, greater awareness. And so to me, the two go hand in hand. You know, it's not like we get to a place where, you know, all of our karma is erased. To me, it's almost like we're just opening up more and more. And then the question is can we love this too? Can we meet this as well?
Can we be with it as it is?
As it is, yeah. As it is. And it's interesting too, because, you know, oftentimes what I'll find is, especially as a teacher, when I'm working with someone, you know, I'll find their thoughts arising in my consciousness. I'll find them coming into my dreams, and they'll say that I'm going into their dream worlds at night. You know, I'll feel their pain. I'll feel their confusion. And then again, on a collective way, I mean, and you know this, as being a father, you experience this with your children and with your wife, your partner. And to me, it's utterly amazing. And in each moment, it's like you were saying, can you show up and be with this?
Yeah.
And I always say, can you be with this with love, with openness, with inclusivity? Whereas, you know, if we are an egoic consciousness, we're with this in a very closed way. And so again, this is a teaching that's opposite of bypassing. It's radical inclusivity. And when we include, you know, we're less likely to have a big, you know, fat gaping shadow or big fat gaping wound. And we're less likely to be surprised when we find that or find some level of that within myself. Anytime I find something, you know, really harsh or, you know, radically intense, or, you know, sometimes when I've looked deep and just found like roots of genocide within my own consciousness, I looked at that and there was a sense of, oh yes, this is here too. You know, both being the victim and the oppressor. And I say, oh yes, of course that's here within, you know, within my biology, within my DNA, within the collective consciousness. You know, if I looked at it and saw like, oh wow, how could that be here and be ashamed of it? You know, then oftentimes the desire is to repress it, act like it doesn't exist. Exactly. And then, you know, basic psychology teaches us, well, then it just comes out.
Yeah.
In a neurotic way, which tends to get us in trouble. That's the funny thing about when you repress something, you know, eventually it will come out and we will get in trouble. And I've had that happen a lot before. I've been publicly humiliated because I repressed something and then it came forward and I said, oh, I need to look at this. You know, humiliation is a good experience because it says, oh, I should look at this. I should go to therapy. I should talk to my teacher about this. Instead of just acting like, you know, I'm the most enlightened person in my community or whatever, you know, shadow place that we could go to in response.
Yeah, so one thing I've also found is that the when we've had that experience of purifying some deep trauma or of working with a certain flavor of challenge, then we have the capacity to heal that in the collective as well.
Yeah,
so we
that's so true.
Skill in that area. So I find there are certain kinds of things that when I run into them, I don't have a personal history with that specific flavor, so I'm not as good there, but this is some other place where I have lots of experience with that one. So I know how to process that in a really smooth and easy way. So it's a being able to look at our stuff, it makes us better at processing the whole.
Yeah.
And that doesn't have to happen on some overt level where you're kind of working with someone on their stuff necessarily like you do. It can be a simple matter of as it comes up in our consciousness in the collective, we're able to process that in our experience. There's some value of that.
Well, I think that's a huge value because, again, that points back to, you know, what I call the law of oneness. It's like everything, you know, because we're just connected to this flow of evolutionary divinity. You know, when you work on something, it's actually helping to liberate that very thing in other people, you know, who've come perhaps before you and as well after you. And you start to liberate things within the field. And I mean, I can remember my poor teacher, oftentimes he would look at me and, about, 5 years after meeting him and being an intense devotee, of his work, my life just took this incredible turn where I was so involved in so many different dramas and train wrecks. And my teacher just used to look at me and said, Craig, like, what is going on in your life? And it was just like one drama after the next. I was just an utter failure. I was really good when I was with him, in the teaching community, on the path. I spent most of my time there. But as soon as I set foot, outside of, the retreat center, it was like I was just immediately getting into trouble.
Karma time.
it was karma time, but it was also interesting because it was very much like you said, later on in life when I became a therapist, very much, one of the reasons was because I had so much drama. I wanted to know, how do I work with all this human stuff? So again, that's the opposite of bypassing. I said, how do you work with this? Because it's just kicking my butt up and down. But I found so many people started reaching out to me. And when they did, they would have, they had that exact story of the very pain that I went through. And I thought, oh, this was my pain, my karma, my confusion. And, perhaps it was. But then, like you said, I was very skilled at working with that very thing with the person who was seated before me because I had went through it. Whether it was a couple months ago or, 8 years ago or 10 years ago. And I just found it so helpful. That I went through the ringer in so many different ways, because like you described, then I could be skilled in this department. But, it's also good to know, and I think very, to have some ethical insight of what you're not good with, to know what you are good with and where you can be helpful and where you're untrained or where you're, you have a shadow around. And I think, the great assumption with a lot of spiritual teachers, especially if we're looking at someone as awake, is that, okay, they're awake. And so therefore they know how to do, they know how to do everything. They know how to be a good parent. They know how to solve all relationship problems. They know how to deal with finance. They know how to deal with, whatever it is going on with your life. And, it's very similar to asking an awakened teacher, are you a good plumber? It's like, oh no, probably not a good plumber. They may not know anything about relationship. In fact, if you ask their wife or their husband, you may find that they're terrible at relationship. Yes. You ask their children, they may be terrible with parenting. You look at their bank statement, they may be terrible in response to that.
Even with teaching itself. Teaching itself is a skill. Just because you wake up doesn't mean, and that's kind of like one of those myth things too, that somebody's awake is supposed to be a teacher. The vast majority of people who are awake are not teachers, and they don't necessarily have that skill. And I taught meditation for a little when I was younger and did some teaching activities like that, but it wasn't what was called here. That wasn't the form I was asked to express at. And so writing was something I thought I was terrible at, but that was what was called instead.
Well, the thing is too, is you're such a clear writer and you're such a brilliant mind. And to me, when I read your work, it's incredible. And me, I did the opposite thing where I thought I could write and I would sit down and I'd feel this incredible transmission flowing through me. But then, when I would hand it to my editor, or any number of editors, they'd say, Craig, what is this? Everything is upside down and backwards. You have every word capitalized, your grammar's all off. They have a hard time with me. But archetypally, it's interesting because, I did come in, just as a teacher, and I've always felt that, throughout my life. And I even taught high school for a while, and it just felt like a perfect fit at that time.
Well, both of my
energy of being a teacher, but I just, of course, I didn't want to teach high school for the rest of my life.
Both of my parents are university level teachers or college or university level teachers, so I kind of thought it was in my blood or something. But of course, life had different plans.
Yeah.
I mean, it does give me that orientation. I did get that from my family, but the actual role in the world was different.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that I wanted to speak about today, and maybe we'll speak a little bit about this and then wrap it up here, was I wrote, you know, was just thinking about, you know, just three great protectors, you know, to protect us from ethical lapses. And, you know, one of the things I wrote down was education and training is a good one, you know, like what you were describing, an ongoing investigation of oneself and one's shadow. And then having some level of supervision, peer support, willingness to receive feedback. And we touched on those. And all of this within a space of humility. And it's interesting because a lot of spiritual teachers, they've read books, you know, they've been to retreats and this and that, you know, but they don't actually have any training in how to teach or how to work with individuals. A lot of teachers or individuals on the path haven't had an ongoing investigation of oneself with, you know, relationship with therapy or an investigation of their shadow. Most teachers certainly don't have supervision of any support, you know, and it's it can be humorous, but it can be ridiculously damaging as well. And then, of course, is a sense of humility, you know, to have an ongoing attitude of humility. It's
we do have to recognize. Yeah, because we do have to recognize that if we bring our stuff and dump on our students and that kind of stuff, that then there's that to be healed as well.
Exactly.
The consequences from that. So it's much better if we're dealing with our stuff in house. And I mean, certainly there can be still things happen, but if we're the more conscious we are, and the more we take it seriously as a profession, I guess you could say, whatever role we're playing, it's good. And it makes a good point too, because you know I've been focusing on writing and that kind of thing, and I get people writing me all the time, and I make a lot of referrals because you know it's really clear for me, for example, that I'm no therapist, and sometimes people come to me with clearly issues that require the support of a therapist. And so I have a page where I list, you know, links to people such as yourself who can support different kinds of things that can come up on the spiritual path. And looking at the ASI, I sat in on the some of the early discussions when you launched at SAND last year. And I thought it was a useful reminder, you know, of being clearer on the boundaries, where it was appropriate to be offering advice and where it was appropriate to be offering referrals.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is just so true, because, you know, if we sat back and just listened to say, for example, the questions, you know, that spiritual teachers get, say in Satsang or just in their email inbox, you'd see a lot of those questions, actually questions need to be addressed in therapy and don't have anything to do with, say, you know, non-dual spiritual awakening or this or that. I mean, you know, you could use mindfulness as a blanket to, of course, speak about anything in life, but, you know, a lot of questions, you know, that come forward.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw Ajahn Shanti when he came up to Vancouver at one point.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd read several of his books and seen videos and so on that I really valued, and I thought it'd be wonderful, a chance to see him. And he took questions after talking for a short while. There was this huge long lineup of people wanting to ask questions, and they were almost all along the lines of, "Oh, my life's a disaster," and, you know.
Yeah. and that's, you know, that's an interesting
poor guy. I mean, here he is teaching or talking about waking up, and they're all kind of like,
yeah. And of course, you know, they're intimately connected, you know, the two, but it's just good to know where your training is. And Ajah, he just happens to be highly skilled teacher, and he's able to, you know, flip-flop back and forth. But you know, if I quoted him one day, I'd say, you know, Ajah, a lot of times you're more like a therapist than a spiritual teacher. You know, and his response is, because, you know, one of the things spiritual teachers do is they hold a space. In theory, it's a space of love. It's a it's a space of peace. It's a space of inclusivity. It's a space that's willingness to receive the wound, the pain, the heartache. of another. And it's like, oh, wow, that's, isn't that what the space of therapy is like or should be like, you know, depending upon your, you know, the level of, you know, the consciousness of the therapist. And it, you know, it can be very similar. But of course, you know, I've seen people too who, you know, who've got up, you know, and spoken to a teacher. And of course, I get these questions all the time where, you know, I say, hey, why don't you schedule some time with me? Or why don't you, you know, ask your therapist to sit with you in this degree? You know, healing every aspect and every level of your trauma in this moment, you know, probably isn't, you know, the right place, or to try to transcend it all, you know, just in one moment of insight or one meditation retreat. This is going to require some deeper work, some profound work,
yeah.
You know, and to be met consistently. You know, I think it's important that teachers don't think that they have to have, you know, all the perfect answers, you know, just sitting there in their pocket at their disposal. You know, I think it's important, like you said, to know when to refer.
Yeah, and you can certainly get that impression when you have, you know, when you're, when that inner silence is alive, it has a yeah. quality of intelligence and so on, and it can certainly seem yeah. sometimes like you have all the answers, even though it's not you that has the answers at all.
Yeah.
But it's still coming through this vehicle.
Yeah.
And this vehicle has been trained and cultured in certain kinds of ways to do certain kinds of things. And, you know, you can't suddenly become an astronaut just because you woke up. You know?
And then that's so true. And, I can even think that even within my career, especially if I just look at this last retreat that I taught, oftentimes I'll offer an answer, you know, in the moment. And then afterwards, you know, because my groups are small, I can go and check in with the individual. And I say, hey, do you need a little bit more support around this?
Yeah.
And then offer them, you know, a whole different range of support, you know. So sometimes there's the support in the moment. Then there's the support I could offer in a session. And then, of course, even a referral, you know, for them to be doing more yoga, for them to be meeting with a chiropractor, massage therapist, somatic therapist. You know, whatever it is, also go see a medical doctor, you know, or whatever. But, you know, and I've done that before oftentimes too, where I've met with someone in the satsang hall and gave them, you know, an answer, you know, like you said, from a place of silence and what felt like was true in the moment. And then afterwards followed it up with, hey, you know, also if you're deeply struggling, there's no shame in, you know, going and seeing a psychiatrist and looking at medication as an option as well. And I think it's important that we meet an individual on all levels of their being,
yeah.
not just one level, because that can be quite dangerous. It can be quite powerful, but it can also become quite dangerous and even unethical to some degree.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, it's been good to sit with you, David, and it's been a real joy, a deep respect for you. Anything else you want to share or add on the topic of ethics or growth or the shadow or
there's all kinds of things, but we could go on and on for a while. It's a big topic, but
yeah.
It is important to understand that there's a process of maturing into it. Actually, it might be another way of putting it, of maturing into the into our spiritual process. And it's not even though the shifts themselves might be instantaneous or near instantaneous, the process of maturing and embodying that process. So it takes time.
Yeah, yeah. That's so true. Well, thank you so much, David. Why don't you tell everyone your website again and, you know,
sure.
how they can get a hold of you if they're interested. And
okay, it's davidya.ca, davidya.ca. And there's a contact form on the website and so on if people want to ask questions or whatever.
Yeah, and we'll put some links down in the description. Of course, if anyone's interested in these types of conversations or being a part of the Association for Spiritual Integrity, again, there'll be links in the description below. It's been so nice to have you today, David. Much love to you, my friend.
Namaste.